I'm Daniel Juergen, Vice Chairman of IHS Market and Chairman of CERAWeek. I want to welcome you to the CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Market. Today, we have the opportunity to talk with Patrick Poirier, who is Chairman and CEO of Total, one of the world's major oil and gas companies, and indeed today, a major energy company. Patrick, welcome to the CERAWeek conversation. We look forward to discussing with you both the near term, what's unfolding in the midterm, and then even looking to the long term.
Thank you, Dan, for welcoming me to this conversation. I'm happy to join you today.
Thank you. Patrick, a little while ago, you said that there are three major challenges facing the industry today. I think it was a message to Total's own employees. COVID-19, the oil price drop, and of course, the longer-term question of climate. And I thought we would use that today as the, really the frame for our discussion. So let me begin first by asking you about COVID-19, how Total is dealing with it, what it means for your operations, and what it means for your people.
Of course, this is the major short-term challenge. We'll come back on the two others, but this is a reality we face today. And priority is, of course, the health of all our employees around the world. So we had to take actions because in France, you know, the government decided a few weeks ago already to put us, to close us at home, to confine us. And so we have to be stringent with that. So in fact, the offices are almost empty everywhere in the company, which means, by the way, that it is a good lesson that we are becoming more a digital company. All the management committee knows how to use Teams and other tools. And I would say that priority is obviously health. People. So a lot of telework, a lot of action on the ground as well, because the other priority was to maintain, I would say, our operations. So we have been obliged to reorganize the company by Team A and Team B in order to be able to manage these the quarantine system and to be sure that production on all the sites will be supported. It's not easy. We have been obliged to amend the rotation system, because we have a lot of operations in Africa, in the North Sea, and to amend the way we work. But it's working well for the time being.
Production is safe. Team A, Team B. What does that mean? How does that actually work?
That means that we have organized the work on each side so that one Team A does not mean Team B. I mean, so Team A is working the colleagues are working, and during this time, the other one is not working at all, and they don't meet. That means that the first team will clean everything, and when the other will come, the place will be cleaned, and they will just transfer instruction by writing. So we try to safeguard half of the company, I would say Team A and Team B, in order to avoid, I would say, cross-contamination. That's a basic fundamental idea. More complex was, I was saying, offshore rotation, because there, of course, one of the key things is to avoid to have any contamination on the platform, because, you know, it's a closed environment. So we need to be very stringent. So we have obliged all the teams which are going offshore on platform to be quarantined during 14 days before to go on the platform in order to avoid cross-contamination. In some countries, we have organized also testing the people before they go offshore. And there again, for the time being, operations are safe, except on very small field in North Sea. We maintain the production across the world. We have to take also other actions in order to repatriate most of our people, expatriated families, non-essential people are back to their home country. We think they are safer there than staying abroad in harsh conditions for their health as well. So I would say many actions, and I would say it was a priority, to be clear, of the last 2-3 weeks, health of the people and maintaining operations.
So obviously you're a global company. Air transport has stopped among many countries. Has that been a problem for you to just get people across borders?
Yeah, it is. It is fundamentally. And that means that, for example, the rotation system on our offshore platform in Africa are working today with people who stay in the country. They don't come back home today. They stay in the country. So I would say they are 4 weeks working, 2 weeks in quarantine, 2 weeks resting somewhere, but they stay there. And I would tell you to repatriate people from when you have, we have around 2,000 expatriates and the families, 5,000 people across the world. It's not so easy. So we have been obliged to mobilize some planes ourselves. But the company is well organized, I would say. This is, you know, when you are a global company with work people and families around the world, crisis, I mean, having crisis plans is just fundamental, and taking care of the health of the people, the safety of them is, I would say, at the core and the DNA of the company. So we have activated very early all the competencies in this type of area so that we can handle and offer to our people a safe situation, which of course is just fundamental for us.
You mentioned that this is the direction of the company anyway was to go digital. And I think you have what you call the digital lab within Total. I guess these circumstances have turned into a giant digital laboratory for how do you operate the company digitally.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But we know we discover a lot of ways to work together, and it's quite efficient. We continue to work. You know, we didn't stop meeting. We didn't stop working. We just use all these tools, which oblige us maybe to make a step in the future. I would also say that we benefit from some of the initiatives, for example, being able to have one central control room to control all drilling operations around the world. This is becoming, this type of tool are really very efficient today because, you know, having less contact, less people on the ground and understanding, or the central control room as well for rotating machines is helping out. So all these tools which were developed, I would say, are creating even a greater value today in these circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, clearly you wouldn't have been able 15 years ago to deal with a crisis the way we're dealing with it today. We just wouldn't have had the tools.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right, because in fact, thanks to this type of discussions, and we can really continue to work. And 15 years ago, you're right, it would be a disaster without communications, you know, we are with all these means. So that's part of the, I would say, the positive part of this crisis.
Right. So meanwhile, the reality is what's happened to oil prices. Obviously, they'll fluctuate day to day, week to week, and right now they're back at a level that may be higher than people thought a week or two ago. But you've structured the company now to operate at, or the goal is to be able to operate at $30 to $35 a barrel. Is that a correct understanding?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I mean, yeah, to be clear, it's not new. I mean, we draw some lessons from 2015 that fundamentals in our business, in our industry, is to control the break-even. So we had a break-even under for $25 per barrel, to have a strong balance sheet in order to be able to weather the volatility of the oil price. To be honest, I was not thinking that we could face such a situation. You would have asked me the question 2 months ago in February when I made my roadshow to investors. I was far from this world, but you know, on March the 5th, on March the 6th, the oil world has fully changed suddenly. This weekend will remain in all our memories, you know, COVID-19 plus the decision of OPEC and non-OPEC countries to exit the deal, and from Saudi Arabia to increase its production. It creates a dramatic impact on the market. So, you know, we have to take action immediately because $10 per barrel represent for us a difference of cash flows of $3.4 billion. So between $35 per barrel as an average of the year, which means we had 55 the first 2-3 months, now $30 makes $35 compared to $50-$60. It makes a difference of $9 billion for us. So we have to find them, you know, and there is no way not to take action. And then you come back on what you control, you know, and what do we control? We control the delivery of the asset. So it's why we priority today is to maintain as much as we can, as long as we can, the production of all our assets around the world, delivery, I would say, and the other part are the costs, spendings. So we have to spend less. And so then we take action and we look again to our CapEx program and what is flexible, you know, short cycle, flexible CapEx. We had that in our portfolio, so we activated it. So $3 billion of CapEx will be saved. And then we have to ask our teams as well to take actions to save on OPEX, you know. And we maintained in total, I would say, a cost-saving program. We didn't stop it. So we had just to activate it in a larger way and to ask our colleagues to double their efforts. Which will not be easy, but I'm confident because we've done that in 15, 16. So I know it's a matter of motivation in the company.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you how important the experience or the lessons of 2015 and 2016 are in terms of helping you in through this current crisis.
I mean, for me, it's just it's fundamental. I became CEO end of 14, just before the crisis. So I knew at that time there was to take difficult decisions, but to find a way to work. Today, we know what we've done. And in the meantime, thanks God, the company is not exactly in the same situation. So gearing is lower, the break-even is lower. But at the end, you know, the levers on which you can act are the same. So it's a matter of delivery. It's a matter of costs. And I'm repeating today, in the company, when I became CEO, I was working with three words or four words: safety, delivery, cost, and cash. I'm just repeating the same ingredients of the recipe today across the company. I just added HSE because it's health, safety, and environment, but delivery, cost, and cash. And there is no miracle. And I think the people knows, you know, in this industry, when you think, I was thinking recently that, you know, I came in 99, we experienced this type of crisis, 2008, 2014, 15, and now to 20. So in fact, in the last 20 years, we had this type of low cycles. And we faced these low cycles several times. So we began to be...
And it's interesting, each one is caused by a different thing. I mean, and each one comes in a sense, to some degree, as a surprise. Certainly 2008 for many was a surprise. And 2 months ago, 3 months ago, the notion of pandemics was something that people just did in scenarios.
That's true. But two, 3 months ago, we knew that the market, the old market, was inventories were continuing to grow and was not a very strong market. Of course, it was supported by the OPEC policy and the non-OPEC policy, pricing policy. But they reaffirmed in November 19 when they decided to make an additional cut. Unfortunately, this COVID crisis has created a damage among these alliance between the parties. Quite surprisingly, because to be honest, on the top of a demand crisis, you have a lack of demand, obviously, because of COVID-19. We are adding a supply crisis by increasing the supply. So we do things, the market, I mean, the players in the market are doing exactly the opposite of what we should do. So I think that's why the price has crashed. And I hope that we'll find ways to get out of that.
Yeah, it is very strange to be adding supply at a time when demand is disappearing, which is what
we've been very surprising. But, you know, that's why sometimes this is why these type of policy are not easy to exercise. But, I mean, I think, unfortunately, the result of all that is that the inventories are continuing to grow. And people even think that we don't have enough I would say storages around the world in a few months, so we'll be obliged to stop product, shut in some productions. And that will be the main effect for me. What will be, as we are growing inventories, this crisis on oil price could last longer than the COVID-19, because then it will take time before to empty all these storages and to get the markets rebalanced.
Yeah. Does it look to you like we're getting close to running out of storage?
I mean, I've exchanged it with my tradings about it. It's not so easy because, you know, in this industry, we don't have many storage wells around the world. You can imagine that China, for example, will benefit from this situation to store, to grow their strategic storages at $30 per barrel. It's a good bargain for them. So you could find ways to probably to store oil, but that's true that there are some trading houses which consider that there is a risk, and so that action needs to be needed. But I know that, let's be clear, in some of our refineries in Europe, we continue to run them, but we have put them at a minimum level, and because there is no demand for gasoline of gas oil today in Europe, or less and less demand. And so I'm not sure we'll be able to maintain these refineries in operation for one month more. And so at the same time, that means that if the refineries do not take oil, this will have an impact on some production on the fields, you know, and I understand that in some countries already, they have taken actions to reduce production in order to manage their own storage capacities. So action needs to be needed quickly now.
Are you struck by the gap between sometimes what you see in the market in terms of futures prices, the financial price for oil, and the difficulty of actually selling cargoes right now?
No, for the time being, we have no difficulty to sell cargoes, but clearly the markets do not reflect I mean, the indicators of the market do not reflect the reality of the market. You see some spreads between all that. But on the total side, we did not have difficulties for the time being to sell cars.
Right. And I gather you're still keeping your petrol stations, your gasoline stations open in France.
They are all open, 95%. We need to do that. We have even taken, our colleagues are willing to let them open. So this is a service given to the people, even if honestly the activity has diminished by almost 50%. So, right. But they are all open, all of that are open.
So you pointed to something that I think will be an issue that will be very significant when this crisis ends, which is the buildup of inventories, of storage. Is that something that you're concerned about?
Yeah, because I was reading a paper I asked my strategic team about the crisis in 1985, 1996, and 2014. In fact, there is different. These three crises are more or less common. It was a problem of, supply and demand going the wrong direction. Each time, the duration to recover, but the leading factor for recovery for the market, rebalancing the market, was the size of the inventories, which were too over inventories, you know, and we face that. And it takes time. It's not, even if the demand come back, if the inventories have grown too high, too high, then it will take time to come back out of, low cycle. And so this is why I hope that the producing countries will take action quickly, because it makes no sense to continue to
grow. Yeah, because otherwise they're going to live for a long time with these inventories.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, one thing, Patrick, that really struck me, as you said, 85, 96, 98, that period in 2008, at least in the first two times, although the price went down and oversupply, demand went up. But what's different, of course, about this crisis is that demand is disappearing as long as the world is shut down.
Yeah, but this demand will come back. I mean, I'm more optimistic. I think, I don't know if it will be in 3 months or 6 months. Nobody knows exactly how long this, COVID-19 crisis will be there, but we'll exit. I mean, I have no doubt that it's a matter of weeks or months. So then the question after that will be at which pace the economy will manage to come back to a normal situation, what will be the new normal. But I think it will come. Having said that, during that time, we continue to produce oil and the inventories continue to grow. So that's a difficulty. You know, you create an imbalance which could be longer than just the recovery of the COVID-19 crisis. It's why I'm worried today. And I think it's why also we prepare the company and we have decided, like we've done at the beginning of 15, not to think that price could come back by miracle, but we need to take action immediately in order to prepare the company to face a low price of oil for 2 years, you know, which, you know, 15, 16, it took 2 years and a half before to come back to more acceptable prices by middle of 17. We are more in bad mood today, and we'll see if I'm really thinking that it's just a V crisis. It will be longer for the oil industry.
Right. What about natural gas, LNG? I mean, the focus is so much on the oil market, but the gas market is pretty important too. What do you see there?
Well, it's not new. No, it was already there before. I mean, we know that it's not a problem of lack of demand, even if the crisis is creating some demand. From this perspective, the fact that China is going out of the COVID-19 crisis quicker than the rest of the world is obviously very important, because it's a very important customer. But that's true that we are facing also a strong supply in that business. It was the case in 2019. So we said that this will exit this oversupply by 2021, 2022. So, of course, the COVID-19 is creating a lack of demand, which could make this oversupply longer. So that's true that all the parameters are not really economic parameters. Oil price, gas price are not very supportive today. But again, that's part of this commodity business to face this volatility.
What is the message of confidence that you send to your employees?
My message is that I told them clearly, you know, we face the reality, and I was very clear. By the way, my message has been broadcasted worldwide, even to our investors. You know, we decided for the first time that what I said to my employee was good also for all our stakeholders, including the investors. I told them that we already faced that situation in 2015. that we are stronger and much more resilient because we took actions. You know, we have rotated 30% of the portfolio in order to have a low break-even. It was under $25 per barrel. After the cuts, we have decided it's even under $20 per barrel. So we have a good balance sheet, 17% of gearing. So that means that we can have access to more debt. By the way, last week, we exit, we go to the debt market and we have levered 3 billion euro easily and we could do more. But we also know, and I told them as well, that we managed to be more resilient because of their actions. So I trust them. This was my message to them. We can do, we have done it. We will do it again. And so I'm sure that, you know, it's the advantage being to face volatility of the commodity business. As I said in a speech 2 years ago, I think, the size of the company really matters. The size of the balance sheet really matters. Low break-even. And so that means that we are probably among the oil players, the largest companies, and Total in particular, we are well-positioned to weather this storm more than others. And it could even give us some opportunities, you know, in this type of environment. So today, it's not the time. Time is to really take actions internally in order to focus on our operations, focus on our costs. But this type of crisis could also offer opportunities to players with which are the strongest one.
So as you have said, of course, this crisis will end and you need to think at the same time, longer term, as you've described. One of your big initiatives has been to think about and to position Total as a energy company rather than the traditional oil and gas company. And how has that been changed by this?
No, I don't think so. It's even reinforced my conviction. I think, as I said, we face another crisis, what I call the climate challenge crisis. It's really for oil and gas companies. We would have had that conversation in Houston at CERAWeek. I think it would have been the main focus of the discussion. Unfortunately, that weekend, everything changed. But I would say it would have been the main focus. I think this is the reality. There's a society is requiring global society. I mean, there is really expectations, and I think we need to take that into account. Of course, and so our strategy, that's true, is to extend to become, I would say, a broad energy company, oil and gas, but also low carbon electricity, but also carbon neutrality solutions. And I would tell you then, people think that we have, if we invest less, we will have less money for this new energies. In fact, among the decisions we have taken, we have safeguarded the budget, of CapEx budget for 2020. We said $1.5 to $2 billion for these new energies, mainly low carbon electricity. But we will spend them. I mean, I said, no, we need to safeguard the future. This is a strategy. And of course, we have to adapt ourselves to the short-term challenges, but at the same time, let's keep that view. So we'll maintain this budget. And I think it's important. This is not only a matter of, I think really it's answering to what the society is expecting from us. And fundamentally, it's, you know, the energy markets are changing. We want it, we don't want it. And even, I think this crisis, what is happening there with the oil price, could even, is another, for me, example of the volatility we face. You know, the answer that we brought on the strategy was focus on low-cost oil. I'm even reinforced after what is happening. So low-cost oil is just fundamental. Focus on natural gas as well, on really the best projects in natural gas, energy projects, and develop in low carbon electricity, which, by the way, you know, people criticize sometimes these PPAs, renewables PPAs with lower returns, which are, I would say, when we deliver, we can deliver 9-10%. But you know, at $30 per barrel, the profitability of some upstream assets is not at 9-10%. So I even see, from a pure economic model, in this type of long-term, stable, renewable PPA, some stabilization in factor in our economic model, you know, like our marketing business is giving, our retail business is giving us. So it could even be, from a pure business model point of view, be considered as a sort of increasing the less volatile part of our portfolio in order to be able to continue to cope with the volatility of oil and gas price. So the lesson is that we need to continue to execute our strategy.
And it is, of course, integration, not vertically, but horizontally, to give, as you say, stabilization. You've spoken about the energy transition really as a matter of technology evolution that maybe people are not framing the question correctly. And I wondered if you could share your thinking on that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for us, the energy markets are changing on the because of the climate change, because of the technology evolution, innovation, that's clear, and also because of societal expectations. That's a must. And we see that in Europe when, you know, the Green Deal, governments want really to go to getting to net zero by 2050. And this, they will take actions in that direction. That's clear. So, of course, for a company like Total, it's a matter of how the energy markets are moving. And what we observe, we want it or we don't want it, is that clearly we have a shift, for example, in transportation from oil to more electricity, to more hydrogen, to more gases, I would say. And so that's part of the evolution. So our strategy is to try to anticipate these market trends and to be to stay and to be a major player in this new, I would say, new gases. All new electrons, I would say. So that's why we put in that this strategy. So this energy transition is, for me, is not just a transition. It's adding new markets, new technologies. You know, you don't get rid of the past, but you are adding, you see an evolution in the market, and Total will be a player of these markets. It's why we have decided to invest in electricity, producing and to distribute it as well. You know, so we have 5 million consumers, you know, in Europe in the power, in electricity. But we are also growing a production segment, either through CCGT or through renewable production capacities.
Right. And you see carbon capture will be part of this picture.
Yeah, it will be part of the picture when I describe the, yeah, because it's a question of all the carbon neutrality solutions, I would say. It's you develop carbon capture either on the technology side or for nature-based solutions. So, yes, we are investing in these two segments as well. It will be part of the neutrality of the world. You know, of course, the first duty for a company like Total is to lower our own emissions by ourselves, is to act as well on the products we distribute to our customers, so to diminish the carbon content of the products. For example, promoting biofuels so that you can decarbonize oil, promoting hydrogen or biogas so that you can decarbonize gas. So acting on products is also important for an oil and gas companies. And acting on emissions, acting on products, and also developing new energies like being a key player in the electrification of the world. That's one of the big trends that we observe.
So, Patrick, let me end with a question that's a sort of almost a philosophical question. You're an energy company, but you're also, Total is also a global company. And before this crisis, people were talking about how the world was becoming more fragmented, borders, boundaries going up. And obviously, that happened much more sharply because of the attack of the virus. How do you see the challenges for a global company operating in a world that seems to be more fragmented?
Yeah, that's clear, but you are perfectly right. A few months ago, we made what we called an evaluation of the major risks for Total, and it was, I pointed to by both these risks as being one of the, probably the key ones, because I observe a sort of fragmentation in the world. That's what's true for trade barriers. And look again, the reaction of the world to this COVID-19 crisis is quite astonishing. You know, on one side, there is no way to contain the COVID-19 in one country, you know, because people are circulating around the world, planes, and we are one planet, in fact. We are one big country. We want it, we don't want it. We behave on a day-to-day basis like that. And the reaction is each country is trying to safeguard its own border, you know, even in Europe, you know, not a single policy, containment policy, which means that it will be difficult to exit, by the way, because it will be a matter of trust between the countries, who has really the right policy to exit this COVID-19 containment policy. So I think that's clear, but for major companies like us, we have built our companies on the concept of, I would say, world no barriers, a world taking benefits of the world, and I think we are among the winners. It will raise for sure some question marks to us, I would say, in terms of supply chain. Having said that, we should not forget that thanks to this globalization, we were able to get the world out of poverty, you know, so it was a positive factor. So I would say it would be a mistake to suddenly believe that fragmentation and localization is a new world. I mean, and I suspect my view is that even if I can read a lot of articles about we will not exit from the crisis in the same way we entered, at the end, I'm convinced that the advantages of the globalizations are much larger than the risks and the fears that they could have in a more fragmented world. So I hope we'll not have this type of behavior. Fortunately, this is what we observe there again during this crisis.
Patrick, you've emphasized one of the great lessons to come out of this COVID-19 crisis, which is the importance of collaboration, of exchange of information, and of openness. And let's hope that's a lesson that the world will learn for the future. In our conversation today, you've touched on three sets of major issues: how the COVID crisis is affecting the industry and how a company like Total reacts to it, the impact of the oil price collapse and how you plan and adjust and your strategies to it, and then the longer term questions about energy transition, technological innovation, moving towards a more mixed energy world, which will be the issues that will be on the table again when this crisis passes. So it's been a very valuable and a very thoughtful conversation. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us for this CERAWeek conversation. And on behalf of IHS Market, I want to invite all of you to join us for the next CERAWeek conversations. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.